In early 1650, the rebellion of the Fronde had reached an anxious equilibrium. The Grand Prince of Condé and his grandee allies were in the dungeon of Vincennes after a dramatic break with Queen Anne and Cardinal Mazarin, and rebels in Paris had been momentarily pacified. With the crowns of authority apparently restored, the Cardinal and Queen in April dispatched a company of Swiss guards to the Condé
residence at Chantilly, where the prince's family had been exiled. The show of force toppled the first in a series of dominoes that would ultimately touch off the chaotic second phase of the Fronde, known as the Fronde of the Princes. The Princesse de Condé fled by night from Chantilly, barely escaping the evil Mazarin's perfidious claws, as she would soon tell the judges in the Parlement of Bordeaux. She shepherded her son, the six-year-old Duc d'Enghien, to the southwestern city, the last safe haven available to this innocent prince of royal blood. At first, they were received ambivalently by the Bordelais authorities. So, the princesse and her entourage worked concertedly to win over the necessary elites and corporate bodies of the city. In this effort, and throughout the civil war that followed, the princely party would appeal insistently to their audience's emotions. In a speech that would quickly be published as a Mazarinade pamphlet, the princesse recounted her harrowing voyage, during which she had suffered, quote, a mother and wife's worst fears, for whom the apprehension of losing a husband and a son who have the honor to be of royal blood cannot but inspire dark thoughts. Enghien himself supplied the coup de grace. Kneeling before the assembled judges, he implored them, quote, be a father to me, monsieur, for Cardinal Mazarin has stolen mine. The lachrymose scene of a young prince begging a corporate body to act as his father, I will show, encapsulates some key elements of the princely Fronde in Bordeaux. In all cases, the princely party relied heavily on affective language and logics, but they tailored their uses to particular audiences. With powerful institutions like the Parlement, Condé and his allies speak of friendship and loyalty, and lament the injustices and injuries committed against both sides by the royal party. But for the city as a whole, with its unprivileged denizens, the prince adopts a paternal tone, seeking to elicit love and submission in return for protection and care. In both cases, the interlocutor is nearly always treated as a unitary body, literally as a person, in order to render appeals to the sentimental registers intelligible for their audience. Finally, though Condé tried to tailor his appeals to the sentiments prominent among each audience, he hit the mark in only one case. In the other, he missed like Malcolm X at a Trump rally. Before moving to my analysis, a requisite bit of background on Condé and the Fronde. In 1648, when the rebellion began, the Grand Condé was a popular French hero. Much of that goodwill was eroded, though, as he cast his lot with the royal party against the rebels of Paris. When he commanded the siege of Paris in early 1649, he became a duplicitous villain, barely better than the hated Mazarin himself. Later that year, an explosive rupture with the crown over perceived slights led to Condé's arrest and imprisonment throughout the year of 1650, whereupon many French people celebrated his downfall. His family and remaining allies were exiled to the family chateau at Chantilly, though they soon fled to Bordeaux, the historically pro-Condé and irrepressibly rebellious capital of Guienne. From the spring of 1650 through the summer of 1653, princely allies worked to rehabilitate the Grand Condé's reputation, first in order to secure his release, and then to build support for a civil war against the cardinal and queen. To do so, they produced more than 1,000 Mazarinade pamphlets in which they highlighted, often in melodramatic terms, Mazarin's alleged injustice, deceit, and treachery toward the prince. Against such sins, they contrasted Condé's passion for the king's service and proposed that all those who claimed to love France must fight to curtail the horrific abuses perpetrated by the Italian cardinal minister. I focus on the princely Fronde in Bordeaux because, I argue, that time and place gave special resonance to particular species of sentimental politics. The city was capital of Guienne, the recently annexed, highly privileged, and perpetually unruly southwestern province. Almost a week's ride from Paris, the Bordelais felt and even cherished every inch of that distance. Lately, the sense of distinction had manifested in a long succession of tax revolts and uprisings against the Duc d'Epernon, the mortally hated governor of the province and staunch ally of the cardinal and queen. Bordeaux in 1650 presented many advantages then for the Condean faction. Historic affection for the prince's family, distance both geographic and metaphoric from Paris, and shared complaints of abuse and deceit by their mutual enemy Mazarin and his cronies. I perceived that the city hosted an emotional community in Barbara Rosenwine's conception that emphasized terms of honor and distinction among the city's power elite, which made appeals to injustice and grievance potent tools for persuasion. Condé played well to this audience. However, he badly misjudged a second emotional community among the middling sort of people. He viewed them as in need of a protector, a father figure, whereas the dominant mood was radically egalitarian, emphasizing generosity and cooperation rather than loyalty and submission. Finally, a brief historiographical note. The pamphlets that streamed off presses in Bordeaux were the subject of Christian Jouot's seminal study, Mazarinade, La Fronde des Mots. His central claim there is that Frondeur pamphlets were a literature of action, as he calls it, whose aim was not to convince its audience in intellectual terms, but rather to elicit a response and compel cooperation with the author's party. Jouot focuses especially on the Mazarinade's material qualities and rhetorical strategies, dealing minutely with the near-term circumstances that conditioned each tract's effects on readers. But I believe that attending to their emotional valences can reinforce and extend his analysis and, more broadly, enrich our understanding of the Fronde. Reading the Mazarinade as sentimental texts, as Sarah Knott has labeled tracts from the American Revolution, can illuminate key purposes and functions of Condé's rhetoric in the moment. But more broadly, tracking success and failure of princely propaganda in guiding readers' actions allows us to roughly gauge how effectively they harmonized with the mentalities and emotional communities prevalent among their audiences. Reading these texts back against the actions they were meant to elicit opens at least a small window on the emotional states of different strata in the city of Bordeaux at a moment of acute anxiety. So we turn to those sources. Just as Enghien had begged the Parlement to, quote, be a father to me, the Grand Condé and his brother, the Prince of Conti, continued to interact with the city's governing bodies on essentially interpersonal terms. The young duke's request had implied that the Parlement was, in some sense, his father's peer, if it could stand in for him as a guardian. The aristocratic brothers extended this flattering suggestion in a lengthy, published correspondence with the Parlement and the municipal council called the Jurade. They addressed the corporate bodies in precisely the same terms as with friends or valued clients. On the very day he was released from prison in 1651, for example, Condé wrote to the Jurade to, quote, thank you for the favor that my wife and son received from you, and to implore you to continue your friendship toward me, which I esteem in the highest regard. On the same day, he wrote in grateful terms to the Parlement, quote, do me the favor of believing that I will never underestimate your goodwill, and that I could never count myself happy if I did not, by every sort of service, show you my sentiments. Similarly, as Condé rode from Paris to Bordeaux in late 1651 to begin his open war against the crown, he wrote again in emotional terms of the joy that I have to arrive in a place from whence I've received so many assurances of affection, and to whom I owe in part my liberty and the safety of my house. It's interesting to note here the slippage from where to whom over the course of this passage. In all cases, the brothers signed their letters, quote, votre très affectionné à vous servir, a style employed with highly respected recipients, from foreign rulers to French grandees. Over the course of their voluminous writing, Condé and Conti established the personal bonds, comparable honor, and affective ties of obligation that built a friendship between approximate peers. If the style of interaction emphasized shared status and honor, the substance of these letters emphasized shared struggle, once again in terms of sentiments. As the princely Fronde reached its climax in the summer of 1652, the prince wrote to the Parlement to thank them for their support against, quote, the cabals that have formed at the royal court, both against the security of the state and against my own. He took this as a sign of, quote, the zeal that you have for the peace of the kingdom. Mazarin and the rest of their mutual enemies understood well, Condé warned, that they could work, quote, against the liberty and well-being of the people, particularly of your province, as soon as they had removed Condé's protection. Therefore, surely, quote, you will agree that my fortune is inseparable from your own. Both prince and Parlement had suffered injury and ignominy under Mazarin's hateful oppression, whether living under Mazarin's despotic ally Epernon or by spending 13 months in a dungeon. Now, both were united in grievance against the cardinal's tyranny. The judges formally agreed with Condé's assessment that their fight was one and the same in a proclamation of union with the princely party from 1651. They explained to the king in a separate pamphlet that, quote, the malice of Condé's persecutors has rendered the designs of his affection and of his obedience still useless, and given your majesty evil impressions of his conduct. Therefore, the prince has, quote, asked our company to unify its sentiments and interests with his for our common defense. As such, your court of Parliament, interpreting the sentiments of your justice, has agreed. To win the necessary support of Bordeaux's Parlement, Condé had played on the shared emotions bound up with an elite sense of honor, and especially the feeling of persecution that both he and the judges shared. The prince asserted the mutual dependency of their battles against Mazarin, emphasizing the passion, the zeal that drove their protests. In uniting with him, the Parlement spoke of their affection for the king's service and significantly framed their joint venture as a union of sentiments, justified by their view of, quote, the sentiments of royal justice. At every turn, the princely alliance with the Parlement was formed and expressed in sentimental terms. Now, Condé would attempt, with, let's call it, rather less success, to align himself with the common folk of Bordeaux along emotional lines. He failed, not because emotions were an ill-suited tool, but because he and his pamphleteers grossly misjudged which emotional notes to strike. In pamphlets aimed at the city's common folk, Condé sought to cultivate a paternal image in order to claim direct power for himself. The most overt portrayal of the party's desired hierarchy comes in the pamphlet entitled Guienne, Victorious at the Feet of Monsieur le Prince de Condé. Here, Condé appears as a protector and Zeus-like master of thunderbolts, who is, quote, governor of Bordeaux and all the province, and will reign forever over the city. Elsewhere, the bon Bordelais are said to cry to the governor, quote, blessed be the adorable hand of our cherished savior, who has rescued us from drowning in the deluge of blood, which would have inundated and annihilated this broken and divided province. But Bordeaux's affection and subjection is not a matter of respect for the prince's title. After all, Epernon had enjoyed no such deference. Rather, the city loves the Grand Condé as children love their father or a wife or husband, for his power and especially his protection. This family romance of the princely throne, to borrow Lin Hunt's phrase, establishes Condé as Bordeaux's affectionate guardian, just as he is to his son. To drive this point home, the Duc d'Enghien assures the personified Bordeaux in another tract, quote, my papa cherishes you, and France loves you. In all things, you and I are but one whole. Our hearts are united by so strong a knot that there can be no doubt of your happiness. Elsewhere, Condé himself recognizes the fatherly obligation toward Bordeaux, especially after their blessed protection of his family during his incarceration. He's supposed to have said, quote, if Bordeaux has need of my arms, this obligation is so powerful that for her, whatever I have in this world will all be employed. The message here is consistent and clear. The city should, nay, must, continue to love and obey the prince in order to enjoy his protection and avoid the annihilation and rivers of blood that would otherwise follow. And I think we can all agree that the choice is clear. And yet, this tactic found only limited success. On the plus side, the prince's secretary reports in his memoirs that this metaphorical relationship was taken quite literally by one Bordelais gentilhomme, who, before going into battle, told the prince, quote, I will be killed, but you will see me as calm as in church, because I recommend my children to you. Likewise, and in a more formal sense, the notable residents of Bordeaux, as they styled themselves, proclaimed Condé a father of the people in a letter from November of 1651, just as his civil war is beginning. All well and good, but Condé needed more than gentlemen and notables to accept his fatherly authority. He kind of already had them on his side. He required the support of the common folk, and on that score, his appeals to paternalism fell woefully flat. We may judge the effects of Condé's pamphlets not just by the words of the people, but by their actions. Over the course of the princely fronde, a faction of Bordeaux calling themselves the Orme, a faction of the bourgeois calling themselves the Orme, rose to prominence and ultimately to power in the city, and they made a habit of defying their presumptive princely fathers. The people of the city had a very independent agenda. Though it was no less emotionally freighted than the prince's, the operative sentiments were not insecurity or fear. Rather, the Orme promoted a feeling of egalitarian obligation to defend their city as an entity with honor unto itself. Their foundational manifesto declared, quote, fidelity to the well-being and advantage of our patrie, for whose privileges and franchises, both capitalized, of course, we will always be prepared to sacrifice our lives and our goods. In return, they demanded a deliberative voice, and not only consultative, in the general assemblies and of the common maison of this city. They spoke assertively in a similar honor-bound vocabulary as the prince or the parlement, and Condé fundamentally misunderstood their sentiments. We see this most acutely in his command to them after they had impertinently butted heads with the parlement in June of 1652. Immediately, he sent word, he was off on the battlefields in the north of France against Mazarin, he sent word instructing, quote, all the bourgeois of the Orme, that they take heed not to offend the members of so distinguished a body as the Parlement, and not to hold further assemblies without the consent of Monsieur the Prince. In response, the Ormes stormed the city's Hotel de Ville and fought a series of street battles that killed seven. Though the princes had momentarily pacified the city after that, the Orme's show of strength had made it the effective lord of Bordeaux thereafter, and struck a significant blow against the princely party's security in Bordeaux, and ultimately their ability to prosecute their war against Mazarin. From that point forward, the princely party were at best equal partners with the Orme, as their rebellion in Bordeaux and across France ground to a prolonged defeat through the summer of 1653. Though the prince had successfully aligned himself with the Parlement's sense of honor and injury, his patronizing sentiments toward the Orme eroded and ultimately erased his popularity with the people. The differential success with the two groups stemmed from the party's misapprehension of the emotional communities that coexisted in Bordeaux. Condé and his stable of authors evidently presumed that appeals to hierarchy and honor would obtain in all cases, and thus that commoners, so socially distant from a prince of the blood, would readily assent to a childlike submission. They failed to recognize the civic and corporate pride, and more importantly, the egalitarian affections within the Orme, and therefore alienated a powerful group of Bordeaux's burghers. Though well-calibrated sentimental appeals remained a potent tool with the Parlement, the tone-deaf efforts to sway the people demonstrate not just the shortcomings of misused sentimental politics, but the potential backlash they could bring. Reading the pamphlets of the Fronde with an eye for emotions thus reveals critical strategies in the princely party's pursuit, too much alliteration, of allies. At the same time, it helps to explain one of the critical weaknesses in their war effort. To return to Enghien's opening plea, while emotional appeals to fatherhood may have helped sway the judges, the prince's assertion of fatherly power over Bordeaux as a whole helped to seal his movement's fate, and not for the better. The Condé party's efforts to transpose their own emotional community onto an audience that had begun to reject its premises reveals, I contend, important dynamics, limitations, and even dangers of sentimental politics. Thank you.